Namaste. Good morning, everyone. It is natural that the new year brings with it new hopes. That is part of being human. Hopes on an individual level, hopes on a collective level of the teaching of Advaita is that one foot is firmly placed in the present moment, no matter what life may bring. And this is the gift of the teaching. The last year gone by has been one of tremendous reflection, individually and collectively. Many seeds have been sown. And as Nisargadatta Maharaj would say, at some point or the other, it has to sprout. That is the grace of the teaching. I would like to briefly touch upon a couple of quotations, and thereafter, if anyone would like to share their experience with the teaching, or if they have questions, then they would be most welcome. It is such a gift that so many of you have come forward and asked questions and clarified doubts, because we receive so many emails from others saying how they have benefited by listening to these conversations. So thank you for the openness, because one person's question is everyone's question. It is a shared experience. That is the gift of satsang, being together in the company of truth. So the two points I would like to touch upon. One is a phrase which was used by a Western mystic called Joel Goldsmith. And it was to do with the common phrase, love thy neighbor. Love thy neighbor. But he expanded the scope of this statement. And he said, my neighbor, it doesn't just mean a person. It means the things near you, the thoughts in your mind, these are your neighbors. Love thy neighbor. So what does love thy neighbor, neighbor being person, place, objects, things, thoughts. If we accept that every movement is an appearance in consciousness, every person's opinion is as valid as ours, then That love transcends a dualistic love. If deep down in the heart the teaching is lived, that consciousness is all there is, everything appears sacred, an expression of that one consciousness. You may not like something, but there is no opposition. To what is, there is an acceptance of what is, and thereafter we do what we think and feel we should do. So if one just imagines right now any object in your room is an appearance in consciousness that is already embraced as the experience, because the awareness of it is already there. A person you do not like, just think about that person. Right now, it is an expression of consciousness. That thought has already been embraced. And then the ego with its sense of doership steps in and says, I don't like so and so because. And when we withdraw opposition to what is, life is no longer a battle to be fought. We may take it that there is a deepening of the teaching when we reach a point where we realize that those who trouble us are an equal expression of consciousness as those who are good to us. Hard as it may be to accept this, if we see the one divine being, consciousness, through every act, if someone we are very fond of gives us a gift, and the awareness is there that it is not the individual giving me a gift, the appearance of an individual giving me a gift, but the one source, the one consciousness through the individual has provided me with this gift. Then similarly, if someone says something we don't like or abuses us, the awareness that this too is an expression of the same one source consciousness, then we stop swinging between the polaric opposites, because we are rooted in being. Now, I would like to read out a couple of sentences of Ramana Maharshi's, which are so very relevant to this message. Many of you might be familiar with the Maharshi's method of self-inquiry. Bhagwan has said that there are two ways to realize the truth. There are two ways. Ask, who am I? And trace the I, the ego, to its source, the self, and allow it to dissolve. That is the first way. But we are discussing the second way. The second way is to surrender the me, that is the ego, to the supreme, which is the state of I am within you. The second way is to surrender the me, that is the ego, to the supreme, which is the I am within you. You see, this is the most beautiful gift of the teaching. Because when your thinking mind, which is the troublemaker, the monkey mind, which is going into the dead past or an imaginary future and creating all sorts of stories about how things should be, when that thinking mind is disengaged, one is by default abiding in the I am, in the presence, in being, in awareness, in the present moment. When the thinking mind is disengaged, because thoughts of condemnation, hatred, malice, jealousy, envy, guilt, shame, blame, none of these arise anymore as a result of the teaching being imbibed, the thinking mind is no longer doing its cartwheels. And when that is not happening, one is rooted in the present. No matter what the situation is in this moment, the surrender of the me to the I am, the surrender of the individual will that thinks I am in control of situations in my life, the surrender of that to the divine, pure being, always ever present, right here, right now. The surrender of the me ritualistically, symbolically. When a coconut, which represents the ego, is placed into the fire, Agni, the fire of divine wisdom. Divine wisdom. The next, I am reading out a sentence from a very close devotee of Bhagwan Maharshi's, Ramana Maharshi's. These are his words. He says, "It is very important for spiritual strengthening to continue to have contact with the truth, whether it is a person, a teaching, an institution, a temple, or a church. This continuum is imperative." You see, the reason it is imperative is because it has to be absorbed into the system, so to speak. One has to reflect on it all the time for a new way of being to emerge. This actually starts happening automatically. Anything that happens today, tomorrow, day after, one starts seeing in light of this understanding, this new understanding. And if one realizes that I've started thinking differently now. I start viewing situations differently. My reactions may be the same, but thereafter, as soon as the event happens, the new understanding kicks in. Because my reactions are based on years of conditioning. When all this starts happening, then one knows that the teaching is sinking deeper and deeper and deeper. The result is always only peace. Those who have touched upon this peace know that they wouldn't trade it for anything else this world has to offer. All right. So if anyone wishes to ask something, they can put their hands up now. Before that, I would like to thank the volunteers who in the last few months have been transcribing these talks that took place in the lockdown. And we are working on a book from these very deep question and answer sessions that have emerged since, I think, March to November. And a lot of effort has gone on, selfless service in this task. And we are also, for those who are familiar with the playlist Pointers from Ramesh Balsekar, which is the first video series that came up on YouTube of mine, that is now being subtitled into Spanish, Russian, German, Italian, in French by volunteers. Some of them devotees of Rameshji who have come forward to make this teaching available to different countries around the world. So if any of you speak these languages, which might be the first language, then do take a look at the Pointers from Ramesh Balsekar videos. That is a summary of his teaching. All right. Yes, Vandana. Vandana, are you there?
Yes, Gautam.
Good morning.
Morning. Good to see you back.
Thank you, you too.
So, I've been reading, and what I wanted to ask you was that as per the concept of Ramesh Balsekar, our destiny is fixed right from the time we are born due to the genetic inheritance as well as the conditioning. However, there are two doubts in my mind. One is that genetic mutations keep happening as we age and all throughout our life. And secondly, our conditioning also changes, which makes, you know, how we respond to certain situations, and we probably get wiser and more experienced as we age, hopefully. So how does that destiny which you were born as a child at that time relate to when you are 50 years later?
You see, Vandana, destiny is what is, because it is destined to be. Destiny is not at a fixed point in time. Mm-hmm. Whatever is destined to happen will happen. That destiny includes transformation in conditioning as part of the destiny. If genetic mutations happen, they happen as part of the destiny, you see. And I'm glad this is the first question which came up, because I wanted to read out something on destiny which I held back from, which now I'm going to. Okay. So, from Ramana Maharshi, mm-hmm. I had marked it and I was going to read it out. Yes. So again, a devotee of Bhagwan's asks him this question. He says, I can understand, Bhagwan, that the external factors in a man's life, such as his nationality, family, profession, marriage, death, etc., are all predestined according to his karma. But can it be that his entire life, down to the minutest detail, is already predetermined? Now, for instance, Bhagwan, I have put this fan in my hand down on the floor. Is this also already predetermined? Bhagwan replied very firmly, certainly, whatever this body is to do and whatever experiences it has to pass through is already determined when it comes into existence. You see, the point I'm making, Mandana, that even that fan being put down on the floor in that moment is destiny. It is not moving away from destiny. Mudaliar did not stop. He put forth further questions to Bhagwan. What becomes then of man's freedom and responsibility for his actions? Bhagwan, looking graciously at Mudaliar, answered, the only freedom man has is to strive for and acquire jnana, wisdom, which will enable him not to identify himself with the body. That is the only freedom he has. You see, Vandana, many people feel this concept of destiny is fatalistic, which is quite a misunderstanding, you see. First of all, destiny is a concept. It is a concept like many other concepts which are part of this glorious teaching. You see, destiny is a concept for most of us to understand that we are only part of the equation of what is. We have been led to believe by our conditioning earlier on that we are in control. Everything depends on us. And destiny is a concept which is brought about for the individual ego to realize that my life's experience is otherwise. Many things have happened that I had no control over. You see? So it is a very powerful concept, but it is still a concept. It is not the truth. The truth is what is right here, right now, as the truth. When a sage, when a jnani, as it is said, destiny does not apply to the jnani. In what way? Because when the jnani is established in just being, not identified with the body, as Bhagwan says, destiny applies only to the body. Destiny applies only to the body, not to pure being. So, to end where you started is that if someone is destined for spiritual transformation, that is also predetermined, no doubt. But what transpires? They come across something, they read something, they meet someone, that is part of the divine blueprint of that person, which will start transforming the earlier conditioning gradually or suddenly.
So just for my understanding, what you are saying is that whatever genetic mutations happen to my body in the course of this life is also predetermined. And what it predisposes me to various diseases is also predetermined.
Yes.
Okay.
Or not.
Hello.
Yes.
Or not. Even that is predetermined.
Thank you. Thank you very much for explaining.
Yes, Rana.
Hi, Gautam.
Hello. Yes, Rana. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, so I was wondering, you know, how can I be ambitious and competitive in my professional life, but not sort of fall for the pitfalls of my ego? Like, how can I be competitive and ambitious, but not egotistical at the same time? You know?
Right. You see, Rana, some people by nature are ambitious, some people are not. Okay, that is what a natural quality that one has. And anything that is a natural quality like this is a beautiful quality to possess. Now, for example, here I had no ambition. I can't recall any ambition that I had. Though I always wanted to do well when I started work and business, it was natural that prosperity is a result of the business. But that driving ambition, I did not have. So that natural quality needs to be honored because that is what moves life forward. The point is that with that quality, are we in opposition to others? Are we making our life so competitive that it can pull down others? It can be only for our benefit? Because if we are living without this basic understanding that everyone is an instrument of the divine, in our ambition, in our blinding ambition, which is most often the case, we tend to trample on others, you see, because of this lack of understanding that everyone is an expression of the divine. So if in my ambition, the awareness is there that whatever happens, it is not possible for me to hurt or harm others. It's a beautiful thing that can really flower, you see. Now, for example, at work, if one is ambitious and one has a goal set, and in that ambition, you know, you're rude to your staff, you abuse them because they don't meet your standards, which will take you where you think you should go, then one has been blindsided by the ambition. You know, so what is the quality of the ambition? How is that ambition translating itself in life? Is it uplifting? Is it carrying people along with it, this quality that one has? Or is it in opposition to people? Because I want to be first. I want to be big. I want to be great. So that is what determines the whole process. Because you see, it is directly linked to your peace. What is the point of being ambitious and not being at peace? Is that ambition worth it? Is that ambition of having sleepless nights and just, you know, creating destruction and chaos in one's wake because of the ambition, is that worth it? Or an ambition which drives me, propels me forward, and helps me take others along with me. Is that not a beautiful ambition as an expression of God? That's what starts happening.
So how should one look at competition in that case? Like, let's say you have a company and you have competitors. Like, typically people are like, okay, you have to have more market share than your competitors. Like, that's how people think.
Right.
So in that case, you can't really think, how can I take them along? Like, you're competing against them.
Yes.
How can you like deal with that dynamic more peacefully?
You see, beautiful question, because, you know, my teacher loved when I would ask him questions related to work because he himself was a businessman. The thing is that as long as the awareness is there, that the results are firstly not in my control. This is also a very crucial point. What happens is we don't overstep boundaries. You know, more importantly, you can call it competitive skills. Let's say it's very common in the business world where you try to poach other people's clients. you see. Now, that is a part of business. But that poaching, is it on merit? Are you presenting your case and asking a prospective client who may be with someone else that, look, here am I. These are my skill sets. Look at me based on my merit. Or, as most people do, are you trying other means? Are you manipulative? Are you bribing someone to shift their account and so on and so forth? Which, in other words, is forcing your will into the nature of the competition, you see? So if one rested in the knowing that whatever goals I have set, all I can do is do my best and the results are in God's hands. With that understanding, this manipulation and harm to the other does not happen. Facts are presented. I'm after a big client because there's good money in it. 10 other people are. That's competition. That's healthy competition. But here am I, on my merit, my team's merit, my education, my knowledge, and look at me for what I am. But to try other tactics, which so many times it happens, you see, that is what the man of wisdom will not really do beyond a point. And most importantly, the competition then becomes healthy competition, not unhealthy competition. You don't hate the competitor. You don't despise the competitor. You don't talk down the competitor. If you live the understanding that they are an equal expression of the divine just as I am, you acknowledge the competition. You acknowledge their strengths. You look at their weaknesses. You have this objective quality about yourself that sees things in a very neutral light. You see, and that is what transforms the whole situation. So that if it happens that the competition gets an account, let's say, and you know them, you might just call them up and congratulate them, you know, because you know it did feel good. They must be feeling good to have got it. So there's an atmosphere of healthy relationships which permeate even competitive environments as far as you are concerned. This is only as far as you are concerned. We are not talking about how the competition is behaving. We have no control over that. This is about our life, our peace, and where we are as far as this whole understanding of the play of life is concerned at work. Does that help?
Yeah, that was really helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Holger.
Hello, Gautam.
Hello.
Beautiful to see you again.
You too.
Deep gratitude for the teaching and for this opportunity to be together in Zoom here. So amazing what all happened in the last year, just through being connected with other people and being exposed to this teaching and having live satsangs, such a generous sharing. I mean, it's amazing what an unfoldment. I almost felt dizzy from so much peace. hard to describe. I could see, it's so amazing. I mean, I heard so many things 1,000 times, again and again, again and again. And suddenly it just clicks, it makes aha. Just this insight that I am not my feelings.
Yes.
It just, and what a release to just see how occupied I was my whole life because I mistook the feeling for me.
Yes.
I was so busy just always having positive experiences, pleasures, and to avoid pains and to all this nonsense of the thinking mind. I mean, so amazing. And I just experienced a deep peace just through allowing myself to relax that those feelings are conditioned and they are not me. And this is such a beautiful space, and just gratitude.
That's beautiful. In fact, you know, it reminds me of what Nisargadatta Maharaj said. He said that when we reach the point where we stop running away from painful situations, which is our default habit, when that stops and the turning happens to face the pain, he said that is a very important moment, because in that moment, the ego has given up this compulsion to seek only pleasure and run away from pain. And when that turning happens, then what he calls, it is the turning away from the self, the lower self, the ego, to face what is. What is in this case being pain. And then he adds, that pain and acceptance of that pain takes one to a far deeper peace than any other experience can give. The running away from pain stops. And as you said, that when the feeling arises and the understanding is that even this feeling is not me, that is when this running away from those feelings has stopped. The understanding and recognition has happened that even this is witnessed, this movement of this feeling is not me, because it is witnessed. The fact that it is witnessed means it is not me. And then, as I said, 1 foot is in cement, which is the cement of the present moment, no matter what happens. That is the beauty of this, the nature of this understanding. Witnessing happens more and more and more. Witnessing thy neighbor, be it a feeling, be it a thought. The beautiful gift of this teaching is witnessing.
And witnessing has wit in it.
Yes.
The presence of wit. I listened to Joel Goldsmith maybe since I was 20, with interruptions in between, but it was always kind of present. And it was beautiful. I was always drawn to it, but in a way, it never really clicked. I mean, there was always this gap. And it's just so amazing, so beautiful. And thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Umayya. Are you there?
Hello.
Yes, Umayya. Hello.
Yeah. Good morning, Guruji, and Happy New Year to you.
You too. You too.
And happy to see you back in the new year. And this is my really and a welcome session. You know, I was talking to my daughter, I have to say Guruji, and I have to see his face and take his vibrations, is what I said. Your teaching really made me a tremendous change. The ultimate goal is live in peace, which I followed up your mantra, accept as it is, and what to do. These are the two words, you know, keep on in my mind, which I move on, pass on to my mother and my brother, which may made my life very easily every day now.
But did it make your life easy?
Earlier, no, I was very, very frustrated. I know I used to be one-on-one talk and etc. Now, as you said, stop running away from pain. So I turned back. This your mantra words makes me calmness and kindness, and the ultimate goal is live in peace, which I'm practicing it. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Most
so
welcome.
Much.
Most welcome. Thank you. Yes, Radhika.
Hello, Gautam sir. I'm so glad that this is the first time I'm attending your talk, in the Zoom session. And I've been following you recently because I consider myself unfortunate, but that is also God's will, maybe, that I got to know about you and your teachings and Ramesh Balsekar ji. So a happy new year, first of all. And I would like to ask that as I'm new to this teachings or trying to, you know, imbibe those, I would like to ask that when we say that to reach the no mind or not to identify with the mind, but it's with the thinking mind that we are saying that or experiencing the whatever the presence is, it is all with our thinking mind itself. Then how do we get rid, I would not say get rid, but how do we not identify with the mind and still experience with this? Because my question is that it is a thinking mind itself that we are saying that, okay, this is not my body or this is not my mind. Isn't it being restricted with the mind itself? So how to, you know, just dissolve even that mind and the ego as well and realize the true self outside meditation as well?
Yes, that's a lovely question. Thank you for asking that. You see, everything is the mind. Everything is the mind. Words, when they are spoken, they are understood by the mind. Right? Even words, not only are they understood by the mind, but when they are spoken, they emerge from the source and go through the process, through the mind, and are delivered. So let's be clear about that. The distinction is that the mind is not just the thinking mind. The mind is not only the thinking mind. This is a very important point to grasp, because our conditioning has been so far that, as you say, that everything is happening through the thinking mind. No. For example, if I say something and it really appeals to you, it is not necessary that the mind understands it. This happened in my case. I'll give you an example. When I read a sentence of Nisargadatta Maharaj, it made no sense to me, but it hit me in the heart like a bullet. You know, and that sentence was, only the dead can die. Later on, the mind came in and said, what is this? I don't understand this sentence, but it has reached home. So, everything does not go through the filter of the thinking mind, and thank God for that. You see, if I tell someone, everything is God's will, as simple as that, some people accept it immediately because that has been their life's experience. There's no resistance to it. Some people disagree that no, it is my will. How can it be God's will? Which is the mind rationalizing the fact that everything cannot be God's will. So in some instances, the thinking mind acts as the block to block any light coming in, because that is the conditioning of the thinking mind. But in some people, or in the same person at different times, the thinking mind is at rest. And when someone reads something, hears something, it is absorbed at that moment. So the thinking mind needs thinking to figure out sentences, teachings, etc., and so on and so forth. But that is not a necessity. You see, the thinking mind, there, I don't know if you're familiar with the two aspects of mind that Rameshji spoke about, which is the working mind and the thinking mind. The working mind is focused on the task at hand. The working mind brings all its knowledge, all its skills to the present moment to deal with the situation. And that is why the working, being in working mind is considered meditation. Because when one is in the working mind mode, the thinking mind is absent. And the most common example, which I have given so many times, which my teacher used to give, is that the surgeon, when he's conducting surgery, he is in the working mind mode. The mind has to be active because he's conducting a surgery. But all his knowledge, all his skills he has brought to that moment. But if he starts worrying that will the surgery be successful or not, this person is so important, if something happens to this patient, my career will be ruined. That is the thinking mind, you see. So is it that the surgeon's thinking mind is operating all the time? No, it is only when these thoughts come that the thinking mind takes one away from the present moment into the duration of time, into imaginary situations. But the working mind is in its pristine purity. You see, that is the difference. The working mind and the thinking mind. So, yes, everything is viewed through the prism of the mind, as you rightly said. But something, anything which appeals to you, where does that appeal happen? Can you say it happens only in the mind? I can't hear you. I think something has happened to the audio.
I was not able to unmute myself. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, of course. I mean, sometimes it like some sentences, as you said, they directly hit us. I mean, to be honest, I am a psychology student. I mean, I've done with my master's recently. But looking from that aspect, that is why I was wondering about mind, that everything goes through the prism of the mind itself. But now when you explained it, I am really, I mean, I do get insights into as to how that works. And thank you so much for clarification.
And, you know, I mean, it's as simple as if two people stand before you, you might be naturally drawn to one of them without them uttering a word, let's say. Right? What is that? What is that?
The vibrations and all. Yeah.
Perhaps. But that's precisely the point, you see. It's not necessarily happening through the mind. In fact, you'll be surprised that there's so much happening without the mind being involved also. And most importantly, deep sleep. Deep sleep, which everyone knows the peace of deep sleep. You see, all this conversation does not take place in deep sleep. Yet, we exist. It reminds me when I spoke about the surgery, about a surgeon who's telling the patient who's on the operating table, "Don't worry, David. Don't worry. I've done this many times before." And the patient looked up at the surgeon and said, "But my name is not David." And the surgeon said, "I know, my name is David." Okay.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Yes, Animesh.
Namaste, Gautamji. Actually, I am an engineering student, and I think from 1 or 2 years, I have been trying to abide in the present moment. And I think in most of the opposite situations, I have been successful. But the only blockage I seem to see is when I am studying or using my analytical mind too much. And that is most of the time. I don't know how to abide in the present moment in those situations. I mean, I'm heavily using my mind, then how to abide there? I seem to lose the contact.
But why would you, I haven't understood the question, because what is wrong with studying or being in the moment? And
There is nothing wrong in studying, but when I study, I leave the now. I don't know why. I don't know how to ground myself there in the present moment.
Now when you're studying, because the studying is happening in the present moment.
The
working mind is always in the present moment. Studying will happen with the working mind being engaged. That is why Sri Aurobindo said that work itself becomes meditation, because the entire presence is brought to the work. But if you start thinking that, oh, this is so boring, oh, will I pass, will I fail, what will I do, all that, that is the thinking mind which has kicked in. But the working mind is in the present moment. You need not want to be in the present moment and have the working mind engaged. Already engaged.
But I think the analysis is done by the thinking mind or the working mind.
Analysis,
I think
this is done by the working mind.
Okay.
The analysis, supposing I'm working on a project and I have to do an analysis, I bring all my experience into that moment to make an analysis. I'm still working in the moment. I am not distracted. My mind has come and focused in the moment to make the analysis. That is the working mind. You see?
Okay.
But when that, there's involvement in that and all the what ifs, what if this goes wrong, maybe I should not do this, maybe I should not do that. When that compulsive behavior starts and one realizes I've lost my focus, then one knows one has got taken away from the working mind.
Okay. So by thinking mind, you mean the inner chatter, the which happens without any effort, like without any control. You mean
yes,
that is the
unconscious
thinking mind.
Chatter. That's
unconscious chatter. Okay.
Exactly. But you know, at your young age, I would not be telling you that, you know, that even in your studies, you have to be in the moment and be a witness to your studying and all that. That's not the right way, you see. The working mind works in its beautiful, pristine purity because it is in the now.
Okay.
Analysis, what we do, what normal people do is we analyze situations till kingdom come. What if I say this to this person, then what will be their reaction? And that is the thinking mind. You see, that is what most of us do. We are analyzing people's behaviors, our behavior. We are thinking. Why? Because we are depending on outcomes. We want certain outcomes. And that obsessive analysis and operating through the thinking mind, that is what happens. If we accepted whatever happens is God's will, if we accepted everyone is an instrument of the divine, then that won't happen. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thanks.
Okay. Yes, Santosh.
Namaste, Gautamji.
Namaste.
Okay, I have a question. We say that there is one consciousness in everyone, same consciousness. And we often heard that there is a, like, someone is of lower consciousness, someone is of higher consciousness. So do consciousness has levels altogether? Or when we heard saying that there's a lower consciousness or higher consciousness, that is something different?
No, you see, it's actually the same, but all levels of consciousness are in consciousness, within consciousness. Consciousness is all there is. Levels in consciousness are expressed in different ways. For example, one way is the system of chakras, you could say. The lower chakras to the higher chakras. But these are all still within consciousness. Nothing is outside it. Now, if someone is operating through the lower chakras, you know, all the fears, insecurities, that is the realm of the lower chakras. You know, if someone is in equanimity, balanced, equilibrium, operating through the higher chakras. So in that sense, yes, there are levels, but there are no levels outside consciousness. So let's take sages and, you know, saints and sadhus. if they are having states of samadhi, those are again levels within consciousness, which let's say the ordinary person is not capable of, because in their case, they have transcended dualistic living, vision, etc., and so on and so forth. So there are levels, but it's not like there is one level apart from another level and that level is apart from the next level. It's all one. It's all one.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yes. Thanks.
Okay. Yes, Monica.
Good morning, Gautam ji.
Morning.
I'm really happy to see you again. The very first sentence you said, like one foot should be down and should be grounded. It means that you are in presence. So it gave me the picture of Sai Baba posture. Like he used to sit as a cross karke, always one foot down. So it's a very nice method to remember what you told me. And everything is so clear till now. The last year, whatever satsang we had, a lot of changes came in my life, in relationship and in myself also. But one question, everything went very smooth. I was listening to you. Roger told that feelings are also not mind. That hit one pop up one question. I used to go in kirtans like Hari Bhajan or something like that. And the feelings which comes on its own and the tears rolled down, that is also not mine. Then what it is that? I want to know that.
What do you mean by mind? If feelings arose and tears rolled down and I put a full stop, what is the difference between feelings arose, tears rolled down, full stop, and feelings arose, tears rolled down, and they are mine, full stop? What is the difference between the two?
The full stop means you are in B, and full stop ke baad, you are in mind.
Feelings arose, tears rolled down, full stop. Feelings arose, tears rolled down. Now, the difference is, who says mine? Who says mine? Isn't that also mine? Who is saying that? Who is saying mine? That is the ego, me and mine, my feelings, my precious feelings, my tears rolling down. You see? But something so natural that the feeling arose, tears rolled down. If the ego does not take delivery of that and understands that that spontaneously happened, in this body-mind organism, these feelings arose and this is what happened. And the story ends there. Then everything is honored. But when it becomes mine, me and mine, there's a lot of potential for trouble.
One more question. So when you are sitting in some kirtans, I don't used to be witness that because I go into that. But now I am feeling if I have to be in presence all the time, I have to witness the kirtan also. Then how I am going to connect? And
that is so sweet that you said that. Isn't it so tiring?
Yes, it is. At that point, I can connect to that consciousness beautifully. And in that period also, I have to put a one foot down. That question.
That's the problem. You don't have to put one foot down. When you are immersed in the present moment, whatever happens spontaneously is allowed to happen. Your foot is already put down. You don't have to put your foot down. Okay. And this whole beautiful expression is allowed. And you don't have to think, oh, this I should not allow. I should have one foot down while this is breaking. That is the mind.
I'm sorry, but that comes spontaneously. I know.
oh, this is the mistake many people make, that I should not be too immersed in this or engrossed. My one foot should be down. I should witness what is going on. That is the mind speaking, you see.
Yeah.
That's very difficult. But the flip side is that when this is happening, I am so immersed in the present moment that there's no room for the thinking mind to operate. I'm just drenched in what is happening. And when that is over, the peace, I'm established in peace. I'm not thinking, oh God, this is over. Why did it have to get over? Now I want to be immersed in it again, and so on and so forth. So this shows that one foot is already down. Because one has seen that this arose as a movement in consciousness and now it's over. So let's not make it this mental thing, you know, which tends to happen when anything is going on, that no, we must be present, we must be aware. Mm-hmm. That is mind itself talking.
Mm-hmm.
It happens. You know, if something happens in life, some news that you get, which may be painful. With this teaching, that pain itself is accepted, that my God, even this was meant to happen. Most people run away from that pain, as we said with Holger. This pain is accepted. That already means one foot is down. You know, one does not have to think, oh, now this pain is there, so I must be established in the present moment. That is all the mind trying to rationalize and make sense of it, which can also be part of the process of understanding. Because we operate through the mind, as Radhika said. But to that effort of putting that foot down, that happens with grace.
Thank you so much.
Okay. One more question. Yes, Priyam.
Hello, sir. Good morning.
Hello.
I'm so sorry, I have a bit of a cold, so I don't sound so good.
Not
at all. I don't have a question. I just wanted to thank you for last year and all the teachings and for how it has practically brought about a change in me. Because I see that externally the world, the life, like it wouldn't ever look ideal or perfect. There will always be things coming up. But now there is so much acceptance. Now there is so much seeing and witnessing of, okay, this has happened. Okay, this has happened. Now there is less urge to constantly want to feel good. So like there was another sort of a recent death in the family and it was right on New Year's. And it was very, it affected initially, of course, there were natural human emotions, but then there descended a peace of acceptance. Then there was again, like, it's okay. Whatever's like God's will is happening. So there was very less ego story, you know, like how the ego wants to kind of feel self-pity and so much sadness and sorrow for itself and goes into a story, why me? So that did not happen. And I could see that there was a detachment. And even right now, like the body feels miserable. There is a very bad headache and I have a fever and I can't sleep. But there is again, this detachment, there's less suffering. So I like there was this story about the physical arrow of suffering and then the psychological arrow again. So I think that psychological arrow part has subsided for me to a great extent. So there could be physical suffering, there could be the body in pain. I used to wonder how Ramana Maharshi in his last years spent so much time in so much physical pain when his body was kind of not in a great condition. But he always said, that's okay, you know, it's I'm in acceptance and the body has to go through whatever it has to go through. So now I get it, like how he was so much at peace with it. So I just wanted to share that and I wanted to thank you for that.
Yes, and that arrow of psychological suffering gets burnt to ash, you see.
Yeah.
That is what happens.
Yeah.
The arrow of psychological suffering gets burnt to ash. So I'm going to end on a lighter note for everyone. And it's a joke, and you can take it in a lighter way. There was this boy who was having nightmares. He was dreaming that there were these demons below his bed, so he could not sleep at night. And he was quite, the parents were also very worried their son is not getting sleep. And so they took him to a psychiatrist and a psychologist or whatever. And the psychologist told him that this is a serious issue and, you know, you're without sleep, you can't function in life. So we'll have 10 sessions of $350 each and you'll be cured. And the boy was shocked. He said, if you don't have that kind of money, and he said, I'll have to think about it. So he left. The poor fellow was so upset, didn't know what to do. Every night he would think there are these, you know, demons and ghosts below his bed. And he saw, he was walking on the street, there was a bar, and he walked into the bar looking very depressed and down. And so he went to the bartender and asked for a drink, and the bartender looked at him and said, my boy, what's the problem? You're looking down and out. And he said, you know, this is the problem. I can't sleep at night at all, because the minute I close my eyes, I think all this is going on below my bed. And the bartender said, look here, it's a very simple issue. Just give me $10 and I'll solve it for you. The boy was saying, wow, $10, okay, done. Next day, the boy was walking on the street, and the psychiatrist he had met was driving past, and he saw the boy was looking cheerful and happy. He was taken aback. So he stopped his car and he asked him, my God, what is this transformation? What happened, you know, so soon? You look completely happy and relieved. And he said, can I be honest with you? So the man said, yes, of course, please be honest. He said, I got the job done for $10. $10, that's all. He said, yes. He said, what did you do? He said, you see, I was so depressed. I went to the bar and I told the bartender about my woes and troubles. And he said, he'll cure me for $10. So the psychiatrist said, what did he tell you? Did he tell you something for $10? Even I would like to know. He said, yes. He told me, don't worry, my son. When you go home, just chop off the legs of your bed. He said, no demons after that. You see, we complicate things too much. That is the psychological suffering which Priyam spoke about. This makes things simple. Life becomes simple. Life flows easier, smoother, simpler. The arrow of psychological suffering is broken. We will sit in silence for a couple of minutes. We'll just change the view so I can see all of you all.